This is the United States Eventing Association's official podcast. Hello and welcome to the program. I'm Chris Stafford. On this week's episode, Mike Huber responds to the proposed changes made by the FEI last week at the FEI Sports Forum, which includes a change of format for eventing, among other things. But first, we hear from Joe Whitehouse, who tells us about the new Course Designers Educational Grant Program. Hello, Joe. Welcome back to the program.
Thank you, Chris. Good to be here.
Well, you're here today to talk about the USEA announcing a Course Designers Educational Grant Program, which I believe was your brainchild.
Yes, it was. We were on a committee call and with the course advisors, and succession planning came up and what were the requirements to be a course advisor in the future, and where was the pool of course designers to come from. And what I did find out that from the course advisor's perspective, that you really needed to be writing at the advanced level. An FEI, you know, maybe CCI 2-star was the benchmark, but definitely have upper-level experience as a rider. And then you look at the number of course designers we have. We've got some great course designers who are wonderful at the levels they're at, but how do we get them to the levels they need to be so that one day they can become an FEI course designer at the highest level, the 3- and 4-star level, or eventually one day become a course advisor. And one of the things that was a little disturbing was that the upper-level riders weren't getting into the program like their predecessors had done. You know, you think of Derek DeGrazia, and you think of Mark Phillips, who are the top course advisors in this country, and they've been doing that job for nearly 20 years now. And at some point, they may win the lottery and decide to go live in Bora Bora. Can't blame them, but then have we got people in the pipeline ready to go there? And overall, in general, do we have enough course designers? And the question came back, or the answer came back, no, we don't. And we need to get the riders involved. Well, you know, the riders, they're trying to make teams. They've just started businesses. They've got maybe wives and children that they've got to support. And it's a long process to become a course designer. And I talked to Mark Phillips about how he started. And he was in his 30s when he took the first steps to be a course designer. And then his competition career continued, and he ran it alongside his course designing development. And it took him quite some time. And now when you get to the FEI levels, you know, there's age limits on when you could become an FEI. After a certain age, then you can't become an FEI anything. So it was how do we get people in their 30s now to think about 15, 20 years from now, what is going to be needed? And that's where I'm coming from, is what is this sport going to need? What is it going to look like? Not just 5 years from now, 10 years from now, 15 to 20 years from now. How can we make sure we have a vibrant, healthy sport in the United States with the level of qualified course designers, judges, technical delegates, all of those things? We need to make sure that we have people training and making the start right now to get there. And just the sheer cost of becoming a licensed official and the time it takes, and the time it takes away from your business or your competition is expensive. So I started to think, what can we do? And we came up with a grant that would take the financial burden off some of these younger 30-something-year-old riders that would help pay the costs and get them incentivized to take the step to become course designers. I mean, starting with the course designers, because I know you know, Chris, that the only thing that is the hallmark of eventing that sets it apart from everything else is a cross country. And if we don't have cross-country course designers to design safe and accessible courses, what are we going to do? Import them all from other countries? That's going to be expensive. So that was the thinking behind this whole grant, and put some ideas together and worked with Derek and with Mark, and went to the other 3- and 4-star course designers in Europe that are actually were working a lot over here. And, you know, Mike Etherington Smith and Ian Stark all said, we'd be happy to help. We can, you know, make it, put it into our schedules to spend time with the candidates. We just need the candidates. And so that's where this all came from. Took it to the board in December. They blew my socks off, quite frankly. I mean, what a terrific board of governors we had that last year's and this year's, because it's continued through this year. The support was tremendous, and they set aside $20,000 to seed it this first year, and then I would go out and fundraise to support this and then other initiatives to make sure that we have a structure in place starting now to make sure that we have what we need there 20 years from now. And I just was blown away. They approved it and got it done, and so we launched it this spring.
So how will this actually be launched in reality, Joe? What are the next steps? How do people get involved, and the time frame for this?
Okay, well, the information right now is on the USEA website. It's under Association News that this grant is available. And if for some reason they can't find it, they can always search on USEA Course Designers Grant, and they will find it. And then it tells you there's documents on there that help explain how they can apply for them. And one of the things is obviously to be able to schedule, you know, 4 days, at least 4 days throughout the summer that they can go and work with one of these course designers. Obviously, Derek's here in this country most of the time. Mark is here quite a lot of the time. And then Mike and Ian are both here working on courses in the U.S. So they can schedule their time to suit the candidate, and the candidate can fit it in with when Mike and Ian or Mark are around. Derek, of course, is available to actually go work with them at their home site. So it's very flexible in terms of time commitment and scheduling. They will have to do a little work themselves in that what we'd like them to do is outline an ideal course that they think would work for them to get them the knowledge they need. And then they would just, we've got an application on the website, and they would just fill that out and submit their ideas for the curriculum that they want to follow. And then an outside panel, an independent panel, will go through all the applications, and they'll select the recipients, and then we'll work from there.
And are they allowed one grant per applicant, Joe, or can they return after time for another grant?
Well, one of the things that is available in there is a second year grant, that if everything has gone well in the first year, and people have to be committed. You know, this is a lot of money that the USEA is putting into their education. And so we want people who are committed and are going to stick it through. And so if they find that they really want to make this a next step, something that they can do when they've decided to step back from competing a little bit, or maybe they feel that they can schedule it so that they can do course designing as well as competing, which would be perfect. Nobody wants them to give up competing. If we have to wait for them to finish competing, you know, many of these riders are looking at getting a team spot, and many of them are now going into their late 40s and 50s. That's a bit too late to get started. So what we're thinking is if they can get started now and get all of this done at the same time, then when they're ready to hang up their boots, they've still got plenty of time to take it up full time. So the second year will be awarded based on their satisfactory completion of their goals for the first year, and if they still want to go on.
Are you thinking at this point, Joe, about the long term and maybe a USCA certification program for your grant recipients?
Well, the USCF has it's a licensed officials program. They will have to follow all of the requirements for becoming a licensed official, but they can use some of the grant money to offset the costs of entering, registering, paying for, you know, they will have to complete a course of study. You know, they have to go to one of the training program for eventing officials. That's the phrase I was looking for. So what we call a TPEO, they will have to complete everything that everybody else has to do. There's no exemptions there. And they will have to get their license from the USCF. But this grant money can also be applied for those registration fees and applicant fees for those things. So USCA won't ever certify them because we don't need to. The USCF will license them. So not as a certification within the US, no. USCA, no.
And so what is the value of a grant, Joe?
We will be offering two the first year, which are each $7,500. So that two candidates can be working at the same time. And those two candidates, yes, could continue for the second year. Hopefully, with sufficient fundraising done by yours truly, we'll be able to put aside more money so that we could actually have another person starting on their first year during the second year of the previous candidates. So we've got, you know, a continuation going on, that we would never be, you know, two people going through year one and year two, and then we start again. We'd like to make sure that we've got that pipeline sort of getting filled every year, you know, new candidates coming in every year. But that's going to be on how much money we can raise to keep this grant available. It's probably, I mean, the course designing is one of the most important things that will ever be done, because yes, it is the hallmark of eventing. It's the one thing that sets us aside. But there, it's such an important job because of the safety aspect, the horse welfare aspect, and that's why we need to make sure that everybody receives that vital education to get it done right.
And a wonderful opportunity to train alongside some of the leading course designers in the world. Joe, a marvelous idea. I'm sure it's going to fly and hopefully produce the next generation of course designers for us here in the States.
The one thing, I thank you, Chris, but there is one other little thing that I just need to add in there. We do have some very, very highly qualified FEI 1 and 2 star course designers. There is a secondary grant available for them to apply. They just would get something like $1,500 that they could use to in any which shape they liked. You know, for instance, if they wanted to go over to England and work with a course with one of these guys in England and look at how they're doing courses in England or France or Germany or wherever, that they could apply for the secondary grant that would give them travel, you know, cover some of their travel costs to allow them to get some international experience to move up to the 3 and 4 star level. So it's hopefully we've been able to accommodate everybody in this. And if anybody has any ideas for doing anything further, I'd love to hear them.
And there you heard it from Jo. And of course, you can contact her via the website at useventing.com. And now Mike Hubert joins us to share his thoughts on the FEI's recently proposed changes that were made at the FEI Sports Forum in Lausanne last week, which include a change of format to the Olympic Games and other FEI championships. Mike, welcome back to the program.
Thank you. Good to be here, Chris.
We should start by saying that these are not final. These are just proposed changes, aren't they?
Yes, that's my understanding. There, some of them are quite radical, which is a little bit concerning to me, because I'm certainly on many of their points. I wouldn't be a proponent of the direction that they're wanting to go.
Well, give us an overview of what is radical about those changes and your take on some of the suggestions.
Well, it's regarding the Olympic Games format, I think that's what's got a lot of people concerned. You know, it was several years ago, I think the 96 Olympics in Atlanta were the first time where in the Olympic Games you couldn't earn what they call unearned medals. In other words, you couldn't do one performance, i.e. one three-day event, and get two medals, an individual and a team. And this affected other sports as well, like gymnastics, where they now, for example, on the all-around, they have to do everything over again. They can't carry those team scores forward, their individual performance during the team competition. And the same thing happened for eventing. See, for dressage and jumping, it's not a factor because they already have a qualifier. In other words, their team competition is their qualifier to move forward to the individual. And the same with the show jumping. Those horses, though, in their discipline can compete twice. It's impossible to do that in our sport. And so when that rule came down, it changed everything. And if you remember, both in Atlanta and in Sydney, they did have two separate competitions. They had a team competition and an individual competition. Obviously, one of the things that eventing does in the Olympics is put a lot of cost on, because it's expensive to build the course. It's more than just having a dressage ring set up in an arena. And so that only transformed through two Olympic Games, where they had the team and the individual. And that brought up a lot of concerns within the sport, because teams were putting their best horses in, for the most part, into the team. And so then riders at that time, this would not be allowed in the new, format, but riders were allowed to ride their second horse in individual competition. David O'Connor rode Gilt Edge in the team competition on one course, and then 3 days later rode Custom Made in the individual competition. Well, the critics would say that, you know, the best horses were in the first part, so it really was a matter of who had the best second horse was going to win the individual. You know, which, you know, there was probably some truth to that. They tried to make it as different as they could. And then they said, well, it's too expensive, da da da. So then in Athens was when they came up with doing the second show jumping round. That satisfied the IOC that it was not the same competition getting two medals, and so they had a second jumping competition for the final people to determine the individual medals. That is the way it has been, and it was the way it was in London and so forth. So we have seen a lot of changes, them trying to make this isolated and trying to make this a different type of competition to satisfy those rules. But now the new proposal is not only two different courses, but two different levels. They're wanting to do the team competition at the three-star level, which is pretty much what the Olympic Games has always been. It's not been the four-star track, because the Olympic movement is trying to encourage more countries to participate. And obviously, if you know, the World Games would be more at the four-star level. And the FEI is not bound like the IOC. So I think that having, again, two courses They're saying that riders can only ride one horse in the Olympics, so therefore they have to either pick to be a team member on their team or an individual at the four-star level. I think that's going to pose a lot of difficulties with, you know, the most countries I think would view most federations' funding is predicated on how you do in the team competition. So if the best horses and riders, you would think that they would want to have on the team. So who does that leave in the four-star individual competition? It doesn't really make sense. I don't think countries want to put their two or three best riders in the individual competition and have their lesser riders representing their team competition. So that, I think that their thinking is, in my opinion, is flawed. And I'm not, I'm just not convinced that having two competitions like that, it didn't work before. I'm not sure why they're going back to it again. So it'd be very tricky, certainly, for federation to decide who would ride in what class. And then there would always be the controversy of who actually was the best athlete. If somebody had a very good performance in the team competition, they would be compared to somebody that maybe won the individual in the other class. So
they're also proposing that the cross country for the team competition will be three star, but the dressage and jumping will be four star level.
Right. Well,
Mike, if you could just comment on the other point they're making there about making the time of the round added for all the team members for cross country and show jumping, so that a faster round of one team member could counterbalance a slower round of another member. What do you think to that notion?
Well, I think that is dangerous. I think that's very dangerous. We've been trying to get people to ride at the appropriate speed. If you're the fourth member on the team and somebody's done the calculations and says, well, you need to go this fast around this course. We saw that in Europe when they first started the CICs at the three-star level. They ran those competitions at 600 meters a minute, and that did not work very well. And so to me, when you're, you know, looking at the safety of the sport, which we've been working very hard on, I think this is just counterintuitive to that. They're also talking about no drop score. So if you have, you know, one horse that doesn't finish is lame or something like that, then your team, you know, is immediately out of it. And they're also talking about, you know, if a couple of members of the team starting early don't get around, then the rest of the team, because it's a team competition, all the scores count, there's no drop score, then they just won't start, they just won't run. Their day is done, because the team competition is only a team competition. So that rider doesn't get any benefit. There's no benefit for him to go around later in the day if he's the third or the fourth member of the team. There's no incentive for him to even start. So I just don't see that. You know, it's the same with some of the new things, for example, like, you know, penalizing flags down. We've had a real hard time with the technology with frangible pins and understanding when they're compromised. In other words, if one horse goes by and hits one, then the next horse breaks it but didn't hit it any harder. Was that because the first horse cracked it or whatever? You're talking about the same thing with the flag. I mean, what kind of system are you going to hook the flags to that would make it fair and the same for everyone? And the jumps have gotten so narrow anyway that to me that's unfair. You know, I just don't see that.
And I understand that these proposals are proposed not just for the Olympic Games, but for other FEI championships as well. So we're talking about World Equestrian Games, the Pan American Games, the European Championships,
It'd be, it'd be young riders, any sort of team competition. Central European games or Central American games, all those would be affected, it's to me a bit of a head scratcher. I just don't understand their thinking and don't agree with it. I felt that when those first came out, I thought Leslie Law had a very good article. I think it was it might have been published in a couple of places, but I thought he had a very good response to that for anybody that can get a hold of that and read it.
Now, they're also
all the changes,
and of course, top of their list, of course, was what they're calling the audit of eventing, summarizing the factors and circumstances around horse falls, coming back to the risk factors there. Any thoughts on their findings now? Because I know they also did some research, didn't they, last year?
Right. I mean, I think it's hard, to put the onus on any one factor about the design of the jumps and the collapsible type of fences. I think all those things have been good safety measures. The whole idea about skinny fences in the beginning is that, a horse would rather run by one than run into it, so to speak. So, I've not read all the data on their latest, research, but, I certainly think that if that's a concern, their idea of the timing of, allowing a rider to make up for a team member's time faults seems a bit crossways because that's really not what it's about. I know they're, one of their directives have been in all of this is to try to make the competition of eventing in particular more understandable to more people and more appealing, so that people can to simplify it and understand it. I'm sure they think that, well, if a horse is out on course and knocks a flag down, that the spectator says, oh, well, that's not as good as the one that didn't knock it down, and so that's why they're trying to do that. But I just think they've gone. They're trying to recreate or invent the wheel, so to speak, in a way that is, I don't think it's healthy for the sport. And I certainly hope that, the powers to be will settle down and realize that we really had a pretty good thing going.
Yes. I guess the question is it change for change's sake? I mean, they will say that the purpose of that survey was to look at, safety, risk management, and widening the appeal of the sport from an on-site spectator and television viewer perspective, to build the fan base, Mike. But is this putting the cart before the horse?
I think it well could be. I think if you're going to, these are very sweeping changes, and I would be inclined to maybe do some trial, some way to do a sort of trial period on some sort of a competition to see how that would work, rather than just putting it right at the top of the sport at the Olympic Games, in other words, you could try, say, at some regional competitions like European Championships or at the Pan American Games, competitions like that, you might try some of these changes and see how it works, but not put it right away on the world stage, where you have a lot more television, a lot more exposure.
And their case, of course, is based on bringing eventing in line with jumping and dressage, the other two equestrian Olympic disciplines. Do you think that eventing has to make the more changes in order to do that than the other two sports? Do they have to compromise as much? Is it fair? Does it put too much onus on eventing to be more flexible?
Yeah. I mean, eventing. As I stated earlier, their format already sort of lends itself to what they're wanting to create with two competitions. So eventing is the one that's difficult because you can't ask a horse to go cross country, you know, a second time. So that idea of moving forward, so to speak, out of one competition into the next is impossible. And that's where, you know, they came up with the idea of the second show jumping round. And that was to appease that new rule that was in place, about having the, unearned medals. And, they're really, nobody is, it's really impossible to come up with the right scenario for that. It just doesn't exist, because what we had prior to 1996 was, as far as for event people, what was the way, just like what we do in the World Games, where you do your team competition and your score also counts on the individual leaderboard. And that score carries over, and the best one in the team competition wins the individual. But that's not allowed now, you know, from the IOC. So eventing has a really hard way to, you know, to break the tie, if you will. You know, there's just no way to make it sensible and the alternative would be to only have one Olympic competition for eventing. That would mean either just make it all an individual competition or all just a team competition. I mean, there's a lot of sports that are only team sports. So potentially eventing maybe would just be a team sport, where there would be no individual. But when you put the individual in, and especially making it a different level, you're allowing a rider only to compete in one, then you're compromising both competitions, because you know, you're going to have maybe the best riders in the world in the team in the individual competition. But maybe one nation will say, you know what, we're going to sacrifice, we're going to put our best riders in the team competition and not let the best ones go in the individual, because we're going to try to win that medal. So it makes then, there's a whole strategic thing to look at if you have the two competitions, about where you would place your riders.
Well, of course, that one of the points they make is to make, for the Olympic movement, making it more accessible to the minority nations, of course. And
right.
But if
sure.
they're looking at the team competitions, they're right now proposing that teams up to three members with no drop score, and teams of
right.
two can participate. So there aren't many countries that couldn't find two riders if they went for your suggestion of just basing the Olympics on the team competition and forgetting the individual.
Well, what I'm saying is that you're not going to get the true, if you have the best riders in the world in the individual competition at the four-star level, then they can't ride for their nation on their team. So then the strongest teams, those are the ones, the Brits, the Germans, the Americans, the Australians, New Zealanders, those teams that have those four-star riders that would be an individual, what then does that do to their national team? Because they can't use those riders in the team competition. So now you're going to have, you know, your second string, so to speak, riding for your team, trying to win a team medal, and that doesn't sit well with me, because you should have the best people in your country representing you on that team.
Right, it just becomes a three-star competition.
It does, and you know, and then, like I said, you might have a country that might say, well, you know what, we're going to focus on winning a team medal. We want to win that gold medal, and we're going to put Michael Young on a three-star horse or on a four-star horse in a three-star competition on the German team. And so he's not going to be the individual champion, but he's gonna represent our country and make sure we win that medal.
Right.
And so to me, that's a flawed philosophy. I mean, how can anybody like that?
Now, another thing, finally, before you go, Mike, I want to mm-hmm. ask you about, there's a technical rule change there. They're proposing a review of the cross-country penalties, a different cumulative penalty system for refusals, 10 points for the first refusal mm-hmm. on course, and then 30 for the second. And then the introduction of a penalty system related to knocking down obstacle flags and so mm-hmm. on. Right. Have you looked at those changes? Is there anything there?
Yes, absolutely. I don't like the penalties for flags. I also don't think that 10 penalties for refusal. If you have a really good dressage horse, I think Leslie, in his article, responded that there was a horse at Ocala that Kim Severson won the dressage by more than 10 points. And she did have an unfortunate refusal on course. Well, that 20 penalties took her out of the running, 10 penalties would have kept her in the lead.
Yep.
And so I think that, you know, you have to have the balance. I remember back in the day, you know, my first international competition, show jumping, the rails were 10 penalties per rail. And then it went to 5. And then it came in line with proper show jumping with 4. So there have been changes in the way those numbers come down, but I don't think the ratio of 10 is enough. You know, on cross country, that should be a game changer, you know, in the competition. And 10 penalties, if you're fast, you know, to me, it would be pretty easy to, you know, for some horses to make the time. They have a stop, only 10 penalties, another horse jumps clear and has, you know, 10 time penalties. To me, that's not the right ratio.
Well, as you said, these proposals are on the table. Nothing has been finalized yet, and we should point out that there will be opportunities to further discuss these in open forums that are going to be taking place during the Pan American Games in Toronto and at the Olympic Group's F&G meeting in Buffalo this fall and at the FEI European Eventing Championships at Blair Castle also later this year. So time to visit them, and time for everybody to have some input there. Mike, will you be contributing to those discussions?
Well, I've not been asked to do so. I actually will not be at the Pan American Games because in yet another sort of interesting twist of the FEI, they've allowed 2 championships in North America on the same weekend, which makes no sense to me. So I will actually be in Lexington for the North American Junior Young Rider Championship. So I won't even be in Toronto. But, you know, I'm certainly happy to weigh in, and I'm sure that, you know, I'm not sure who's being invited to those forums, but hopefully all this, as we've just been talking about, hopefully all those things will be discussed and hopefully cooler heads will prevail, if they, you know, common sense will prevail, I suppose, because I think some of these things don't make sense.
Well, thank you very much for coming on the program, Mike, and sharing your views of these proposed changes.
Okay, good. Well, I hope they get it right, but I think what I've heard right now is it's in my personal opinion, it's they don't have it right. So I'm keep my fingers crossed that we can, that the different federations around the world and the people that'll be sitting around that table can come to some smart decisions.
And you can, of course, weigh in on this topic and any other that we cover here on the show by contacting the office. Just go to the useventing.com website. And a reminder that you can download this podcast from the iTunes podcast store. Just look for USEA and download that to your smartphone or tablet app, such as Podbean or Stitcher. The transcript of these podcasts is available on the website at useventing.com, where you will find all the latest news. Until the next time, thanks for your company wherever you are in the world, and enjoy your eventing.